From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Some things still off in the American housing market. There are hot spots where prices are soaring, where bidding wars break out in the front yard. But overall, nationally, sales slid last month. Home building is cold. America's growing, but the housing market is stalled. What's going on? This hour on Point, home ownership, housing, and the U.S. economy. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's the real estate market in your community like? Up, down, sideways? What's wrong with the American housing market? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Neil Irwin, senior economic correspondent at the New York Times data and analysis section, The Upshot. His latest big piece in the Times is headlined, Why the Housing Market is Still Stalling the Economy. Neil Irwin, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
So what's going on here? You say that if housing was back on a kind of not pre-bust crazy trail, but if it were just on an average post-World War II American trail, we'd have something much closer to a booming economy overall right now.
Yeah, that's correct. I think people don't realize how long and how deep this housing depression has been. You remember, the housing market really tanked before the national economy did,
yep,
way back in 2006. That's 8 years ago. We've had an entire 8 years of the housing market in this, you know, really difficult position. And we're still, in terms of housing output, relative to the overall economy, it's still lower than it was even at the worst point of the early 1980s recession, the early 1990s recession. Some of these markets that were very difficult for housing and really bad times for the U.S. economy, the housing market, at least, is still doing worse than at the trough of those. So American economic weakness is a story about housing. It's kind of a chicken or egg sort of situation.
I want to get into that with you. It's so interesting, but I can imagine listeners responding in all different ways to this news. Some will be shaking their heads and saying, yes, we see that stalled housing market. Others in some of the red hot cities around the country are going to be wondering what you're talking about, where prices are just leaping up.
That's right. If you're in San Francisco, this is a boom market. You know, prices have been soaring. You have bidding wars. That's true in a lot of East Coast cities as well: Washington, New York, Boston. So it's not a uniform picture across the country. This is a big country. This is a you know, 50 states and $15 trillion economy. So you see different markets and different dynamics playing out. But if you look at the overall numbers, you know, if you go to a bunch of small and mid-sized cities all over the country, you're still seeing builders sitting on their hands. They're not going out and starting work on new housing units. They don't see the demand for it.
Can we look at the numbers that got people's attention, the most recent ones for March? Now, you've got some areas way up. I think I read San Francisco prices were up something like 25% over the last year. But year on year, comparing March to a year ago, sales of previously owned properties, homes, were down 7.5%. Sales of new homes were down 13.3%. And this is part of an overall slump.
Yeah, and I think what you see is after the bust and after the things got really bad, prices fell a lot, you saw a lot of activity that was about investors snapping up properties for, you know, on the cheap. The properties were foreclosed upon. People had a kind of fire sale, had to sell their place, and investors bought those up. And that was really propping up home sales back in, 2011, 2012.
Yeah.
Well, it's 2 years later, and what's now happened is prices have risen, so those investors can't make the numbers work. You know, a house that looked like a good deal in 2012 has now appreciated by another, 15%.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have that investor activity, but at the same time, we don't have ordinary home buyers who want to live in the place coming into the market on a mass scale either. People don't have the ability or the willingness to take that risk.
Here's the weird thing. You've got sales, overall sales numbers really slumping. I mean, down quite significantly here. But you had last month, I'm also reading, the highest price ever for the median. Prices are headed up. All-time high in March, the median price of a new home in the United States was $290,000, 10.5% before the pre-crisis peak in 2007. The jump just between February and March was more than 11%, the highest on record. So you've got sales diving, prices, median price rising. How can that be?
Well, part of what you're describing in the median price rising is what economists would call composition effects. And what happens is if the markets that are booming are places like San Francisco and New York that are very expensive markets, then that brings up the median because the houses that happen to be changing hands are at high valuations. If you look at other indicators, prices are rising, but maybe not quite that dramatically. That said, what you describe is accurate. You know, we have seen this environment where home building hasn't really picked up that much. Home sales activity is actually down, but you don't see new construction, and you don't see but you are also seeing house price increases, which is a strange combination. Part of that might be higher mortgage rates. It looks like there's a lot of factors playing into it.
Average rate for 30-year fixed mortgage recently 4.33%, up a full percentage from record lows, last spring. But people are saying that's not all there is here. I mean, it's as though the middle class and maybe the young just don't have the jobs or the income to buy what's out there.
Right, and I think that's what my research shows is an overwhelming cause of this. It's young adults, people in their 20s, early 30s, who normally, in a normal market, would be in the process of buying their first home or their second home. They're ready to start a family. They're ready to buy that house. And those people are not doing that on the scale they have historically. So what seems to be happening is younger adults are staying at home for longer. They're living with roommates for longer. If they do have their own place, they're renting a smallish apartment for longer. And that means that the demand that normally is there to prop up home building activity, and especially for single-family homes, isn't emerging. And that has a lot of causes that we can talk about more.
Well, give us the numbers on what's called household creation. When people go out and get their own condo or house, that's household creation. And the numbers there really struck me. I mean, you say that given our population rise and the number of houses or units every year that need big repairs or to be rebuilt, we ought to be building, about 1.5 million homes a year to keep up with long-term demand. And we are way below that.
That's right. So we're building about 950,000 a year. You know, maybe if things pick up, we'll get to 1 million this year. Most of the people who study this stuff think that the long-term path for the U.S. economy is something like 1.5 million houses a year that we need to keep up with demand and demographics. So that's, you know, 500,000 a year or so, maybe 600,000, that we're falling short. That's a lot of houses, and that's being driven by households are not forming. So one estimate that I cite in my article, 2.3 million is the number of missing households who you would expect to exist as standalone households, but instead do not exist because it's, again, young people living at home in their parents' basement. It's, you know, seniors, instead of staying on their own, they move in with the kids. People are kind of doubling up in ways that it's driven by the weak economy, but the result is less demand for housing.
I mean, this is pain and discomfort for people who aren't living in the circumstances that they aspire to, that we've kind of been used to, but it's also a huge whack for the U.S. economy. I mean, you say that if home building was on the sort of average, not, again, of the crazy years, just post-war average, it would have pushed our economic growth way up to maybe 4% like the 1990s. It would have brought unemployment down into the 5-something percent range, which is a whole lot more tolerable than where we've been.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's pretty straightforward math, but if you look at the gap between where the U.S. economy actually is and where we would like to be, where a healthy economy would be, just getting housing back to the long-term average would fill 40% of that gap. That's a pretty amazing number. You know, America's economic problem is, to a shockingly high degree, after all these years, still a housing problem. And again, there's this kind of chicken or egg effect where the weak economy is meaning people don't see wage increases, they're not confident about the job market, and that means they don't have the savings to buy a house. The lack of activity in the housing market then is reinforcing that economic weakness and dragging growth down. So it's a tough situation we're in, and we need to claw our way out of it, and that's going to be one of the keys to getting back to a healthy economy.
In most markets, if people can't afford what's out there, prices fall. So what's going on here?
You know, this is an odd situation to see these kinds of price increases, even with the weakness. And I think what you have to remember is prices really did fall a lot from 2006 to, let's call it 2010 was the bottom. So there's still an adjustment happening where investors are coming in, snapping things up. The ratios between rental rates and buying rates are creating opportunities. But it is a bit of a mystery that we've seen such strong price gains in a lot of markets, you know, 10, 15, 20% in some, without that triggering more building activity and more of the kind of construction you would expect to see. Usually if you're a company and you see rising prices, that's a signal to build or to make more, and that's not happening as much in housing.
You say we're kind of stuck in a vicious cycle here. What's at the heart of it? Is it bad incomes, insecure jobs? Do we have a situation where the housing market cannot come back unless the middle class somehow comes back?
Well, there is an interesting question of, you know, how much of the entire post-war experience was itself maybe not a bubble, but maybe out of whack. And maybe, you know, maybe we are heading into a world where the idea of single-family homes in the suburbs is not what people are going to want. Maybe people are going to want smaller places, more in more dense areas. Maybe there's a shift from smaller cities toward bigger cities. All of those things may be true, but you could still have those trends happen. At the same time, there's more economic activity. There's no reason that shift, if those are real, have to be accompanied by 7% unemployment. You could have those happen in a more logical way. You know, I think one other factor in this that a number of people have cited is young adults have more student loan debt than they did in the past. And if you're thinking about buying a house, you're trying to build savings, you're trying to take on a mortgage, that's hard to do if you have, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 in student loan debt sitting on your that you still owe. So I think we have this storm of all these things that are kind of reinforcing each other and making it a tough economy and a tough housing market.
Poorer, maybe, more indebted, maybe, student loans, more unequal. And yet, housing's been a huge part of the economy. Without it, it's hard to see how we get back on the beam.
That's right. You know, if you just look at in a very simplistic way at, you know, what are the areas of the economy that are underperforming their long-term averages, housing's still the big story.
Wow. Big picture. It's great to have you with us. Neil Irwin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the U.S. housing, what, dilemma? Hot pockets, but overall, sales down. Not enough able buyers. A patchwork sort of mess out there. Susan Wachter joins us right now from Philadelphia, professor of real estate financial management at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, author of Inflation and Pensions and a whole lot more. Susan Wachter, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Pleasure.
And with us from Westchester in Pennsylvania, Celia Chen joins us, senior director of the Moody's Analytics Research Staff specializing in housing economics. Celia Chen, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show.
You must have been watching the numbers that came out in March that got everybody's attention here, the slide. What numbers in the American housing picture are really getting your attention, Celia?
Well, the decline in the home sales numbers was a little bit disappointing, particularly the new home sales numbers, which slid quite sharply in March. I think that that data, though, does tend to be very volatile. So on the bright side, it's revised quite frequently, and the decline perhaps will be revised upwards in the coming months.
Celia, take us on a little bit of a national tour. What's hot? What cities are hot? What areas or cities are not now?
Well, I think as Neil had mentioned earlier, San Francisco is a very hot market right now. New York and D.C. are also seeing quite a lot of activity, and home prices are rising very quickly in those metropolitan areas. Those areas tend to be places where there's a lot of economic growth and there's a lot of wealth concentrated. I think that also investors have bid up prices in those markets. So the fundamentals are very strong, and prices are rising very quickly. They are rising more quickly than we would like, but in most of the areas, with the exception of San Francisco, I would say that prices are still pretty much in line with underlying fundamentals like income growth, population growth.
And what about regions or cities that are still having trouble or having trouble now?
Well, these are generally regions where economic growth has been slower. I would say much of the Midwest is very slow growing still, both because of weaker job growth than average, and also because of the demographics, population growth in the Midwest in places like, well, you know, Detroit, in Michigan. Population growth is very weak, and that is a key ingredient in driving weakness in housing markets.
I'm looking here at Miami. Prices up 31% from a 2011 low. Arizona, investors pushed a 44% increase in home prices in a couple of years, but the momentum gone there. I'm reading from one local person. Phoenix area sales fell 26% in February from a year earlier. Total spending on homes fell 16%. So even there, down, Celia.
Right. And well, these markets, the ones that you mentioned, Phoenix, the ones in Florida, are areas where investors had been really pushing in a year or two ago. And so those metropolitan areas saw very strong gains in house prices over the last 2 years. And the investors were looking for cheap properties that they could snap up, flip, sell for a much higher price. And they've worked through a lot of those properties already. So these were homes that were foreclosed during the peak of the housing crisis. The investors have purchased a lot of the bargains, and they're moving on to other markets now where they can still find good deals on houses. So that's why I think we're seeing some slowing in places like Phoenix and Las Vegas and Florida.
Celia Chen, please stand by. Susan Wachter, you've got a big view on all this. What's the big story you tell on what's going on with American housing, Susan?
Well, I agree with much of what has been said by Celia and by Neil, but I think there's another direction which has not been emphasized yet and which is really quite stark, and that is since 2006, there hasn't been a net increase in homeowner households. That is, we have had zero increase in homeowner households. On the other hand, we have 6 million new renter households. That's astonishing. It's the first time in our history where we've gone through, with the history where there's data for, where we've gone through more than 5 years where there has not been net a single new homeowner household.
That's pretty incredible. To what do you attribute that? We've spoken of a lot of things here, but if you had to boil it down, what's that about?
Well, I think the overall picture is consistent, coming from many different directions. Let me just give you some of the, and then I'll come to the bottom mm-hmm. line. The directions here, yes, there has been an increase in prices. It's over, by the way. And that increase in prices, which was dramatic, 12% for the nation as a whole, more dramatic in some places, brings us back. We're not, as Celia said, above where we were, and we're not even near where we were in many cases. Mm-hmm. But what was driving that in 2006 at our height, but what was driving that was investors not only flipping, but investors producing rental housing. And by the way, rental housing starts are up above where they were at their height of 2006. Renter starts are at an all-time high as a percentage. What we have is a massive shift away from homeownership to renting. Now, why is that? And it is in part because wages are down and because unemployment is still elevated. So that's that reinforcing part of the story that Neil was speaking about.
Yep.
But it's also because it's very difficult to get a mortgage. The circumstances under which you can get a mortgage today mean, for one, pristine credit. Secondly, you have to have cash. And housing prices have come back considerably, not all the way, but as you just said, that median price is a new all-time high. So we've got winds against becoming homeowners in this country that have never existed before. And as a result, the homeownership rate is down to 63.3%, which is a dramatic decline from its height at 69% in 2004.
I mean, it can look like Americans are just being boxed in here and then squeezed because many cannot afford to buy a home, so they're renting. I mean, sometimes that's described as they prefer to rent, but, you know, long term, I don't know about that. And then rentals are way up. The percent of gross income being spent on rent, supposed to be about 30%, is what people say makes sense, but it's up and up and up.
And that's just your point is well said in terms of boxing. Rents are rising. So choosing, yes, preferred right now, but long term, still the preference is out there to be an owner. But in the meantime, it's difficult to save for that down payment when rents are increasing.
But, I mean, it almost seems like a trap in which people then just get squeezed and bled, because if the rent's that high, how do you save for a down payment? How do you ever get to that home ownership status?
And it's a real concern, because rents are no sign that rents are slowing down. Rent increase is steady and up, and it reflects other big shifts in America. So I think that we have a long-term squeeze. It's not just a short-term squeeze that we'll get over quickly and we'll get back to normal. I think our normal is a different normal than in the past.
And not entirely appealing here at all. Yes, it got crazy. It got over the top. But if everybody's stuck paying through the nose on rents and can't even afford to get out of that, well, Susan Walker, please stand by. Celia Chan as well. I want to go to our callers. Atlanta, Georgia. David is calling. Hi, David. You're on the air. What do you see, sir?
Hi, Tom. Well, I have a few things I want to say. I hope I have time to get it out. But one of the things is that the shift away from home ownership, I think, is one of the most important aspects in that, you know, home ownership represents security. And that with, especially with this recent crisis, a lot of people don't want to commit to an area. You know, and that movement of labor and that fluidity is so important, especially when they're recovering. And maybe subconsciously people recognize this and they're unwilling to commit to a home. But one of the things I do recognize in Atlanta, in my hometown of Connecticut, is that a lot of people are buying homes but are not owner-occupying. They are renting. And this seems to be a big point and a big money maker for a lot. Since rents are going up, a lot of my my colleagues and my friends, they're seeking to buy to rent. And they're very successful with it. And I think this is just an overall shift away from home ownership. And maybe it's dangerous to use home ownership as a proxy for our economic health, because I think it's just a cultural paradigm that we're just moving away from ownership. And I think that initially a lot of our subsidies and our push for home ownership may be fading away, and it may just be a new culture that we're living in.
You may be right. Susan Walker, David, thanks for calling from Atlanta. Susan, home ownership falling, David throws out a lot of reasons there. Because we don't prefer it or because we can't afford it? What do you see, Susan?
Well, the surveys out there say that most people still aspire to be homeowners. That said, the movement back to cities, and that is real, and to large cities, is the housing structure that are available and also just makes sense to rent, especially if you are going to only be there for a few years and you're young. But what we're seeing is not just that. I think those trends are in the data. But besides that, we're seeing people who are living with their parents later and later. And it's not that they don't have a home. They do have a home. It's their parents' home. And that's obviously not desirable.
What about our economy? David points to job insecurity. You're afraid to buy a place because you don't know if the job that's paying that mortgage is going to be around. You're afraid you may get stuck, can't sell, can't move. Does our job structure line up with home ownership anymore?
There certainly is job insecurity, but the jobs are coming back. And that is going to build in a positive direction going forward. Jobs will continue to come back. So I don't see that as a long-run issue. That is a short-run issue, but hopefully we are going to see the unemployment rate come down, get to normal a year from now perhaps. Celia probably has good numbers on that. But still, even so, I don't see the homeownership rate coming back to normal. And by the way, we're not talking about the crazy period of 2004, 2005, 2006 in terms of selling homes. We're talking about a normal that goes back to the 1990s and 1980s, where creditworthy people were able to save for a home, able to buy a home. But the underlying pressures now are pushing against that, really, the American dream. And again, not the American nightmare of those crazy years of the mid-2000s, by no means. We're talking about getting back to steady, sustainable home ownership of the 1980s and 1990s. But it's a question of whether we can get there.
Aliza is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Aliza, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a broker here in Brookline, Massachusetts, and what we're finding is there's just not enough inventory. There have been 27 offers on many, many homes. I mean, multiple offers.
Wow.
Many come without mortgage contingencies. So,
in other words, they can pay cash.
They can pay cash, or they're not worried about getting a mortgage.
Yep.
They've been pre-approved to the point where they're feel very comfortable waiving that contingency.
Yeah.
So the problem is the middle class American who wants to stay in their neighborhood, their kids are in their school, they can't compete. They don't feel that they can waive the mortgage contingency. They can't go up $100,000 over the asking price. So they're sort of being pushed out of the neighborhoods, but people are still coming in. And I think the part of the lack of inventory is that people have 3% interest rates on their homes now because they refinanced, and they don't want to move.
Aliza,
so if getting the inventory.
If middle class can't afford to buy in their own neighborhood, who is buying? Who's coming in and buying? Where's the buyer?
We're getting a lot of money from out of the country, China in particular. We're getting people, I don't know, you know, they have cash. Perhaps they're getting it from family.
Wow.
Perhaps they're moving from, I have a client who's moving from San Francisco.
So
selling a home out there and moving here. They have the cash.
Yeah, they'll be brimming. Aliza, you've got the tang of full awareness of what's going on there in your observation. I appreciate it very much. Celia Chen, what about the low inventory? What is this about? You would think at a certain point, people need to sell. Why? In many markets, people are saying there just aren't enough homes on the market for demand. Why not?
Yeah, that's been a real constraint for home sales. There are two pieces to this. One is, of course, that new construction has been going on at such a slow pace that there are very few new homes available for sale throughout the country. I think somewhere around less than 200,000 new homes are sort of on the lot to be sold right now. And that's a very low number, probably about as low as it has been since the 1960s. So there are not that many new homes available for sale, and that's constraining sales of typically higher-end homes, which are what home builders sell. And then on the existing home sales front, the market that Eliza's talking about, there are also not that many houses available for sale. The number on inventory is about on par to what we saw back in the late 1990s. And this is particularly concentrated. The lack of inventory is concentrated in certain markets like the Boston's, the San Francisco's. I think months of inventory for sale are about 5 right now for both new and existing homes, and that's considered a little bit on the tight side for a housing market, and it's much tighter in certain markets.
But aren't people retiring? Doesn't that, maybe they're retiring and moving, or people, if the job market's coming back, they get jobs somewhere else, they have to sell. Why don't those things loosen up the inventory?
Well, I think part of the problem, there are two things. One is there are still people who are credit constrained, as Susan mentioned. And the second is when sellers, potential home sellers, don't see much inventory out there, they have a hard time trading up. And they're worried that they will not be able to find a suitable house. Why not stay in the house that they're in right now, particularly when they have good financing terms, they know their neighborhood and so forth. So that is a constraint on they're not putting houses on the market for sale. And then other home buyers can't purchase those homes. So there's that effect. I think also there are still a number of households out there who have negative equity. So selling a house would incur a loss for them. About 10 million households in the United States are still underwater, and that is going to be also a constraint on the inventory of homes for sale. Now, I think on the positive side, home prices are rising. They are not going to rise as quickly as they have been. I think price appreciation will settle down to a more stable, sustainable pace of around 5%, 4% in the next year or two. But rising home prices does pull more households out of negative equity. So those households will feel more confident, will be more financially able to put their homes up for sale. So that will help to alleviate the tight inventory situation. I think home builders are also going to put up more homes because they have so little inventory in their, in their pocket right now. As demand for housing increases, they really are going to see that, they feel it right away, and they will be incented to put up more homes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the U.S. housing dilemma, hot pockets, but overall sales down. And nobody's sure when or if the U.S. housing market is going to come back. Will it come back like it was? What is the proper or believable expectation of home ownership these days in this country? Susan Wachter joins us this hour from the Wharton School of Business, University of Pennsylvania. Very big eye on the whole housing economy. It's a huge chunk of the American economy, and it's hard for that economy to hit the job numbers that we're accustomed to without housing going with some kind of strength. Celia Chen joins us as well. She's Senior Director of Moody's Analytics Research Staff, specializing in housing economics. Lots of response online. A lot of it kind of despairing. Human says the U.S. dream of home ownership is gone, gone, gone. Fernando says he's seeing old houses, high prices, and high taxes. Monica says she's given up on the idea of ever being able to own. We'll come to your calls in just a moment. I want to hop to St. Louis, and Alan Brake is a realtor at Realty Executives of St. Louis. He's out there every day looking at what's going on in that market. Alan Brake, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
What's the St. Louis picture? Does it line up with this national picture of low inventory? Have you been part of this sales falling but prices climbing algebra or something else, Alan?
Our inventory is definitely low. Overall, St. Louis, the housing market continues to be strong, though. Everything seems to be moving in the right direction here. I've been a realtor in St. Louis for 11 years. I'm seeing multiple offer situations, which I haven't seen since the peak of the market. I think in some scenarios, buyers are paying more than the value of the home.
Who's buying, who's not? Who's able to play these days and who can't, Alan?
I think people that purchased their starter home in the peak of the market have had their value increase enough to sell their home. They want to take advantage of today's pricing and lower interest rates. But on the total opposite end of that spectrum, you're seeing people downsizing. Their kids have grown and left, and they want a smaller home that's more manageable so they can decrease their monthly expenses as they look to retirement.
What about mortgage lenders' requirements, what you need to bring to the table?
Well, the programs that were 100% loan-to-value are pretty much gone. There's a couple left here in St. Louis. But you need a significantly higher credit score in order to get the best interest rates. As well, you need good down payment.
What's expected these days? Is it 20% or what's typical?
Well, with a conventional loan here in St. Louis, you can do 5% down, so it's still fairly minimal. But if you pay the 20% down, you're going to avoid that PMI on a monthly basis.
Right. And what about people's mobility? Do you see people afraid to buy because they're not sure if their job's going to stick around or ready to jump in if the price is right?
Well, I think you're seeing some of the most educated consumers we've ever had, at least in my 11-year career. But I think they want to stay transient. They want the opportunity to move for jobs in other cities. So while there's been a strong rebound, there's still room from where the market was, you know, 7-8 years ago.
Susan Wachter, what do you think of the St. Louis story we're hearing here? Alan's describing something that sounds like, from his perspective, like a pretty good balance.
Yes, I think St. Louis is probably a balanced market compared to markets like Boston and San Francisco, where the demand is really heating up. In fact, prices are above or nearing where they were at the height of the bubble, and where we have a huge demand from investors or cash only driving out, as we heard from the previous caller, people who would like to purchase in the neighborhood and who have traditionally been able to. But that's not St. Louis. St. Louis prices have not dramatically risen. They've come back. Housing is affordable. You've heard St. Louis represents this kind of mid-America down payment if you want to avoid the extra heavy expense of PMI. And, of course, with today's salaries being low, you do. You need a 20% down payment. And credit scores are way up. By the way, nationally, credit scores are 50 basis points higher, not 50, from 700 to 750, and compared to the 700 average, they were not at the crisis period, but prior to the crisis, the decades prior to the crisis. So that's an important ratchet up for young potential homeowners who do not have a pristine credit score.
And of course, as you say, banks requiring much better scores to boot. Alan Brake at Realty Executives in St. Louis. Alan, thanks so much for giving us a snapshot of your neck of the woods. Thanks for joining us, Alan.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. Good luck to you there. Monique in Worthington, Massachusetts is calling. Hi, Monique. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a question regarding, since the topic is about shortage of inventory, mm-hmm. I listened to an article on the radio recently about Blackstone Corporation, a multi-billion-dollar corporation that is scooping up inventory across the country by the tens of thousands.
Yeah.
And I would like to know how the realtors, who probably work with them as well, I'd like to know if there's the realtor's response to that, as well as to any experts on your show today about what they're seeing as a consequence.
We'll go straight to that, Monique. Celia Chen, what about it? There was a lot of activity on that front. Susan says that's cooling down somewhat now, but these very big private equity and big investing houses, Blackstone foremost, bought a lot of property. What's happening with that now?
Sure. That's been a very interesting development in this housing downturn or cycle. There have been many institutional investors that have gone into the markets where there were a lot of foreclosed homes. They've bought these homes up and they've turned them into rentals. With an eye, I think many of them with a long-term eye of keeping these properties and using them as income, using the rent as income, and then also securitizing some of the stream of income into investment packages for other investors. This is limited, though, to these markets, the Phoenixes, Las Vegases, places in California and Florida. It's not something that is prevalent throughout the nation. So I think the impact of these investors is going to be limited to a certain number of housing markets. I would also mention that single-family rentals have been around forever. There are many, many properties that are available for rent that are single family. It's just that most of those properties have up till now been owned by mom and pop investors, you know, some households mm-hmm. who own a few properties. So this is not really a shift so much in the proportion of single family rentals, but the type of owners of those single family properties.
Susan, what's the impact then on most Americans of that big investor intervention? I mean, these are high finance guys. Presumably, they're always going to go for that maximum rental and know just how hard they can push. Does this trap more people in the rental economy, maybe forever?
There's no doubt that the move to professional investors in this class has increased housing prices dramatically in the markets that Celia mentioned. These markets have come to equilibrium, if you will, the relationship between prices and rents, far faster than they would have in the absence of this investment, billions of dollars. But as Celia said, in terms of the overall picture of single-family homes that are rented, these are not up substantially. It's a shift in the type of ownership, and especially in some markets. Now, let's look at the upside and the downside of that. If you wanted to become a homeowner and wanted to grab that property at a cut-rate bargain basement price, that's over. The investors are there before you. Secondly, however, on the plus side, these properties are now, they're not abandoned, they're not blighted, they're in
yep.
someone's care, someone's owning them. And also, they're providing rental housing, and that's what the population at this point is demanding, more rental housing.
But how do ordinary Americans get back into sort of prospering with the economy? I mean, for many, their home was the one piece of capital that they had a piece of ownership with. Now, if markets go up, but the upside all goes to big investors out of New York or wherever, doesn't it take away the sort of common man's piece, a little piece of capital in this capitalist country, Susan?
Yes, of course. Home ownership did not work out so well if you came into the market in 2006 and 2007 because of the instability of the financial system.
But historically, that was the one purchase on the system that a lot of people had.
You're right. Over the long run, it was a way of building wealth. Not extraordinary, because in fact returns on home ownership are returns that cover inflation and build wealth when you pay back your mortgage over time. That's been a very important part of a stable structure for America, stable retirement structure, paying off your mortgage, having that home to live in or to sell to for the next kind of housing that you may need. That's been a very important part of America's overall stability, and we need to get back to that. Part of the reason we're in these troubled times where we don't see what's going to be there is basically we've resolved a lot of the problems of the crisis, but one we haven't, and that's the housing finance system. lenders out there are uncertain. They're looking backward at the troubled period, and they're not looking forward because we don't know what the new housing finance system will look like. We still haven't certainty around that.
Is it the finance system? Is it essentially the finance system we're talking about, or is it the job structure and income for ordinary Americans that has them worried?
Well, it's both. I think that there are pressures on both. The pressure is certainly on the increasing wages. Unemployment is dropping. That's a good thing. Wages are increasing, but not at a rapid rate. So this has been a very poor recovery in terms of jobs and wages, and also on housing, and the two are related.
Simon in Canton, Ohio. Simon, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling from Northeast Ohio,
yeah.
And we're right in the middle of the Rust Belt here, and we've seen a lot of population leaving the area and leaving the state. I'm a realtor and a builder,
mm-hmm.
and I've seen it kind of from all different aspects of this crisis that we've been through. And the thing that I've noticed is that as we've, the one thing that's kind of buoyed us in this area is that we've had an influx of money from the oil and natural gas industries. And that has allowed our housing stock to get back to the level where it should be, where people are starting to build again. But it's a more tempered exuberance than it was back in 4, 5, and 6. And I think that it's been strong enough that we're going to see some real turnaround here. But the one thing that I think people are kind of missing is that after 9/11 happened, I think we had kind of a collective psychological letdown, and everybody decided that they wanted to get what they wanted, and they overbuilt in that time period and caused prices to just go crazy.
Yeah.
And now I think we're seeing the inverse of that, where there's a fear of that has been replaced with a fear of I'm afraid to buy, I'm afraid to build, and I don't know how we overcome that.
Maybe some fracking money and gas money may help in your area, but nationally, I think that's a great question, Simon. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more from Ohio, if I may. Carrollton, Ohio. Huck's calling. Hi, Huck. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Yeah, I think one thing that I've been noticing is that there's this huge negative stigma towards renting, and, you know, I've heard it just on this program calling it a trap, and calling, you know, living with family undesirable. You know, I don't know, we're talking about getting the post-war housing boom. You know, I think that was kind of this American pipe dream that we've been fed that isn't really doable anymore. And so maybe we should just focus on, you know, renting practices and doing away with that stigma. I'll take my response off the air.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your call, Huck. I don't mean to badmouth renting, but you're quite right that owning a home was seen as the target, the sort of goal, the perfect setup, and a way to build some equity over time. Celia, what about it? If we go to a much heavier rental situation, is that just as good for this country? Is that fine? No problem.
Well, I think that home ownership is still an important part of keeping the U.S. economy stable. But home ownership definitely got overblown over the last 10 years until the crisis caused home ownership to fall off. So, I mean, you want to have people to own homes who can afford to carry the mortgage payments. So you don't want people
Sure.
purchasing homes that are too expensive. As long as that is the case, it's a very good way to gain wealth for many households. I think that the home ownership rate should settle around 65%, 64%, which is about where we are now. And a lot of this is related to demographics. The nation is getting older, and older households have a very high home ownership rate. So that's going to help to pull up the home ownership rate. I think overall housing is very important for the broader economy, and stability in housing is very important. So we just want to make sure that people are able to afford their homes, and that is very closely tied with the income that they earn and the jobs that they're able to get. I'm actually pretty optimistic about the outlook for housing over the next couple of years, and that is because I do see that jobs are coming back. We've had 2 months of solid job growth now of, you know, around 200,000 jobs per month. And it's still not as strong as we'd like, but I think that with the spring and summer, we'll see much stronger employment growth, and that will really help to generate stronger housing demand. Also, there is some small improvement in credit availability. Mm-hmm. I know that we've been talking about how tight credit is, but it is starting to open. For example, if we look at the number, the share of households who have very high credit scores, 700 or more, that share has actually declined a little bit. The share of people who get loans with a credit score of greater than 700 has dropped to about, 25%. They've dropped to 75% from more like 80%, a year ago. So it's not great. I mean, before, maybe half of households had that much, that high of a credit score. But it is definitely an improvement. And I think we'll continue to see these small improvements as we go forward.
We've got to wrap it up here. I'm afraid we're up against the clock, but you're terrific. And I appreciate your being with us today, Celia, at Moody's Analytics in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Celia, thanks so much for joining us. And Susan Wachter at the Wharton School of Business. Susan, if the boomers all retire and take off eventually, do the prices just chunk down to where younger people can afford them? Do they just come down en masse?
I don't see that. I see prices continuing to rise.
Okay, there's the future. Susan Wachter at Wharton, thank you very much for being with us. Listeners, thanks for all your insights today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.